Hello and welcome to the Squawker Talker podcast. And after what seems like absolutely no time at all, the Premier League is back. The Euros and the Copa America are now firmly in the rearview mirror, and the day job, the old routine, the old 9-to-5 is back. But let's be honest, we wouldn't have it any other way. And on the back of our Euro 2020 podcast, here at Squawker, we are with you every week moving into the new season, serving up a weekly podcast on all things related to the Premier League. But it's not just the biggest stories in the English top flight. We'll also be getting stuck into the major talking points right the way across European football. But before we get stuck into that, the focus on today's show is previews. Yes, we are in preview mode. The Premier League season is just days away, and despite the shortness of the summer break, The Barclays Premier League is back. And on today's show, we've selected three of the biggest talking points ahead of the kickoff. In part one, it's Manchester against, well, Manchester. Jack Grealish's move to City smashed the Premier League transfer record to bits. But despite all the excitement of that, on the red side of the City, generational talent Jadon Sancho and four times Champions League winner Rafa Varane have both rocked up at Old Trafford. In part two, we look at Champions League nearly men Leicester. The Foxes, as we all know, missed out on top four once again last season, but on the back of some very smart business in recent weeks, Brendan Rodgers' side find themselves right in the dark horse race. And then to wrap up the show, we take a look at the three newly promoted sides this season. Norwich and Watford, they're looking to learn lessons from the last time, and Brentford finally get their crack at the big time. Right then, an absolute stack of things to get through. My name's Fergal Brennan, and battling their way to the start line of the season, we have the man with the hottest takes in town, as always, Squawker's very own Mohamed Butt. Mo, how's things?
Oh, I'm pretty miserable, Fergal. I'm just in a deep pit of despair, Great. You know, and misery that I haven't crawled out of since Thursday. I'm just very sad. It's just miserable and sad and misery and darkness. I'm like a goth. I should really paint my face white, paint my nails black, and just be sitting here listening to The Cure. It's everything is darkness and despair with me, my friend. But the Premier League's great, so hey, I'm hyped for that.
And adding some lightness, some freshness, some positivity to Mo's absolute misery, we have Jake Entwistle. How's things?
Yeah, great to be making an appearance back on the Squawker Talker in the backseat role during the Euros, letting you do your thing. Which I didn't envy at all, considering there was a match every day after a season of a match every day. But yeah, I'm not quite as upset about the world of football as Mo seems to be. And as much as I thought I was tired of a bit of football, it's funny how it just pulls you straight back in with the fact that we've got £100 million transfers and the most exciting players in world football swapping clubs in a summer where we thought nothing was going to happen. So yeah, I'm a bit more positive than Mo, I guess.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm upset about Messi. The Premier League actually is quite interesting and very exciting. It's just, you know, the departure of the GOAT is like, you know, it's like, why? Looking up at a picture I forget, it's fine. What's the point, guys? There's no point.
Well, to kind of get your mind off the subject of Messi and the fact that he's done the unthinkable, he's left Barcelona, he's joined PSG, we're all still in a little bit of a state of shock. Every man and his dog has had an opinion on Jack Grealish, £100 million move to Manchester City. Aston Villa have done well on their end of the deal as they look to rebuild their squad. Mo, I've been absolutely dying to get your take on this. We'll talk about Grealish and where he fits into the City side and what's expected from him this season. But just as an actual story, this is blockbuster. Premier League transfer record broken, British transfer record broken. A very kind of strange setup where Villa have come out and admitted this release clause essentially existed in his contract. That was planned, that was, you know, created to make sure that they weren't caught short if somebody came in and bought him. He's now a Manchester City player. He's taken Aguero's 10. He's full of confidence. He's presented to the Manchester City fans. It's happened. And now all the pressure is on Grealish.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, this is like all summer we saw Grealish treated as if he was like, as if he was this mythic, totemic figure in football, which he kind of was in a cult sense, right? Like everyone loved Grealish. He was a majestic, incredible, potent attacking player. But the way he was treated by England fans this summer was like he was the Messiah. But you know what? Now he gets a chance to be the Messiah because now he's playing for the best team in the country with the best players in the country. Now he doesn't have to worry about carrying the ball 50 yards every time he gets it. Now he can start the ball, start playing 30 yards from his opponent's goal. The ball is going to get to him every time. He can cut and field. He can move. He can drift. He can go wherever Pep Guardiola wants him to go, wherever he wants to go if he has that freedom. And now we're going to see what Grealish can do. Like before, we've seen him in hero mode, like constantly, like, okay, guys, put it all on my shoulders. I'll carry the team. And that strain often prevents you from playing your best because you're so concentrated with just saving your team. You can't almost express yourself to your fullest. And to a degree, it was the same with England because of the way England played. Now, I mean, goodness me, he's in the team with Kevin De Bruyne, guys, with Raheem Sterling, with Phil Foden, with Gabriel Jesus. Okay, that's not as exciting, but you know, there's so much talent. Ilkay Gundogan, 12 goals last season. He's playing in a team with all of these world-class players, these established title-winning players. They're going to force him to play well every single week. They're going to be like, look, Jack, you can't slack. You've got to be at it every week. He's naturally a genius, world-class talent. He's now going to get a chance to express that on the biggest stages imaginable, Premier League, Champions League. And like, it's so exciting to see what he can do when he's not constantly having to just try and drag an entire team up and carry it on his shoulders. Like, what's he going to do when that weight, that burden is lifted? Okay, fine. There's a burden of being a £100 million player and having to produce. But I think that's a burden he's going to thrive under, don't you? I mean, everyone wondered, oh, can he play for England? And this guy took being the Messiah for England completely in stride. He was excellent every time he got off the pitch with the entire stadium, the entire country looking at him going, do something great, Jack. Do it now. And he was like, okay, I will then. And he did. So the fact that he can perform under that pressure makes me think that playing under pressure for City is not going to be nothing. He'll be excellent, right? This could be amazing. I mean, I'm agog at the possibilities of what could happen here, like where he could play, how he could play, who he could play with, what positions, what roles. There's almost limitless possibilities here. It's like Loki, when the multiverses all start branching at the end. It's like anything can happen.
Jake, as Mo said, when you look at Grealish at Villa, it was Roy of the Rovers stuff in terms of his performances, his relationship with the fans. And not to do Villa a disservice, but there did seem to be an air a lot of the times of get it to Jack, he'll do something, he'll create a chance, he'll score a goal, he'll pull something out of the bag and get a result for us. Obviously, that's now been removed from Villa and those powers have been transferred over to City. But based on the players that City have already got in their squad, based on the way that Guardiola likes to play, and just looking at some of the numbers for Grealish based on his last two seasons in the Premier League, injuries were an issue last season, 26 Premier League appearances and 36 in the previous campaign. Somewhere between 70 and 80% of the games that he played in that high, wide left role in the Villa team. A fair bit of freedom was afforded to him, but that was his starting position. He's at Manchester City now, where Phil Foden, Raheem Sterling, Riyad Mahrez, Bernardo Silva, I'm definitely missing one or two names there. They're already there. They're already stationed in those positions. Guardiola's been quite open about the fact that I've spent £100 million on this player. I'll play him where I see fit. And Grealish is a confident guy. He himself has said, if I have to play deeper, if I have to change roles, I will. Could we actually be seeing the Jack Grealish that we've seen at Villa that's built up this image and this fable around him now actually being asked to do a different job to really prove just how good he is?
Yeah, the reason I got so excited about the Jack Grealish to Man City signing is not just because of a fee, it's because we could almost see his sort of true potential unlocked, in the sense that Aston Villa played him left wing because that was the highest position and they could build a solid midfield with Douglas Luiz and John McGinn behind him. And that was an incredible double pivot to sort of base your team around, especially as Aston Villa, during their transition under Dean Smith in the first season, they came back up. All of a sudden, they shut up shop and became really solid defensively. And that helped them then build for the next season, in which they performed really well. Adding Emi Martinez again made that step up even greater. So Grealish was given that free role on the left wing and last season transformed into a genuine wide forward. His touches in the opposition box rocketed up per 90, obviously always high for chances created. And you mentioned that he didn't play many games. He still ranked third in the league for that last season. So his output in that forward role was obscenely good. Always the most fouled player, always high for dribbles and carries, which is not actually going past a player, but covering distance, as Mo said. But where I think it's interesting at Man City now is I've always highlighted their sort of Pokemon evolution trio of David Silva, Bernardo Silva, Phil Foden, in which you get this magical left-footed player that starts out on the wing, gets moved into Pep Guardiola's famous free eights, which was all the rage during David Silva and Kevin De Bruyne, I think 17-18 and 18-19. And we saw last season, Phil Foden took his first step, his sort of second evolution stage, in which he was getting his minutes high and wide on the wing. And that's about learning Guardiola's system, learning what the centre midfielders are going to do for the wingers, and also reducing a bit of the responsibility, because those two midfield roles as number eights, you have to do everything for 90 minutes. And it, although Man City have a lot of the ball, that is a demanding role to play. But Grealish is almost like, to continue the Pokemon analogy, which I've probably spent too much time thinking about, Pep Guardiola had that trio set up. So as I said, Bernardo Silva could have played number eight this season, swapping with Gundogan and being Kevin De Bruyne's partner. But it's like if you've ever played Pokemon or got to the end of the game, you have your squad, and then all of a sudden you get a chance to catch the legendary Pokemon who is just so much more powerful than everyone else, and you can't resist but put him in your side. Jack Grealish represents that player because not only is he capable of playing in the on the wing, I think the plan is to ruin that evolution stage that I've said and have him now as Kevin De Bruyne's long-serving number eight partner. And even potentially a replacement if you're looking, and I mean like 7 years down the line sort of thing. Kevin De Bruyne is not going anywhere anytime soon unless those injuries really start to rack up. But I think Grealish will start the season playing left wing, and Foden and De Bruyne's injury means that there's going to be less of a skepticism about, oh, is Sterling going to play or not? Because I think they've actually got enough slots to keep everyone happy. But I wouldn't be surprised if we see Grealish regressing in terms of his position on the pitch, because in the StatsBomb preview of Man City, Ollie Walker highlighted that De Bruyne was second for passes or carries that progressed the ball 25% closer to the goal per 90 minutes. He averaged 9.6 of those per 90. The only player ahead of him was Jack Grealish. If you have those two players next to each other, in centre midfield, then you have absolutely everything. You have incredible athleticism, incredible vision, incredible technique. I just don't think it's a position you can play instantly. So I'm excited to see Jack Grealish do his Aston Villa Jack Grealish, play left wing, carry the ball out wide, drive inside, create chances, create goal-scoring opportunities. Since Aston Villa returned to the Premier League, only De Bruyne has created more chances than Grealish. So that duo is going to be sensational, but I think it's going to take time to develop a partnership.
Mo, there's obviously going to be massive, massive attention on Grealish. Jake's touched on there the different roles that he could play, that we could maybe see a little bit of a metamorphosis of Villa's Grealish into City's Grealish, which we're probably all still getting used to saying. But right the way through the squad, Guardiola is going to roll this line of rotation with a huge amount of matches. We're, you know, fighting on so many fronts and we want to win everything, that he won't really get pinned down on his best starting 11 or the starting 11 that he's going to play in major matches. But inevitably, there are going to be players that kind of, quote, lose out. And Guardiola's been relatively honest about that. He said that Bernardo Silva has hinted that he wants to leave. And he said that he's not the only one, that there's three or four other players. At the other end of the pitch, there's concern over Aymeric Laporte, John Stones' renaissance, and his new contract has essentially said that Diaz and Stones are now first choice. Laporte is kind of lumbered in next to Nathan Ake. There is going to be decisions to be made for City between now and the end of the transfer window. The money they've got is not bottomless. Players are probably going to go in order to bring in a bit of cash. And also because they themselves will know they're not part of what Pep is pushing for in the next 12 months.
Yeah, there's going to be players rumbling. The thing is, as we've seen pretty much all summer, it's not a seller's market, right? It's a buyer's market. There's no one has any money apart from like a handful of clubs, and those clubs have already bought players. So selling players is very, very difficult, especially if they're going to be on the kind of wages City have been paying. What I think is going to be interesting to see is tactically what happens. Because I agree with Jake. I think primarily it's going to be the 4-3-3, and then eventually Grealish maybe will start wide. It's going to be interesting to see if he does play wide, by the way, for City, because the wingers for City have a lot of defensive responsibility. A lot. And I don't know if you want to lumber Grealish with that necessarily. But then at the same time, do you want to then alter your shape So I don't know. Maybe he'll play false nine. Maybe he'll... But whatever. I do agree that ultimately he's going to play next to De Bruyne. That's the idea. Because you look at what he can do with the ball. And he's ideal to be that central playmaker. Villa obviously put him wide left because that's where they could put him. What's going to be interesting to see is what Pep does with the formation. Because I want to see him play a back three. I want to see him play the 3-3-1-3. The old Cruyff formation, because I think that's going to make the best use of his squad, right? You've got three central defenders already at the club, top-class ones, and you've got Kyle Walker, who's shown he's very good defensively in a back three, right? And then you've got this amazing surplus of midfielders, right? They're just outrageously good midfielders. And you've got these two guys, De Bruyne and Grealish, who are like the ultimate, like free eights, right? But you almost don't want them to have to defend too much because they're so good in attack. And you've got like Riyad Mahrez, good winger, Bernardo Silva, good winger. Phil Foden has done really well wide, you know, without having to come in field. He's really excellent wide on the left, he showed in the Champions League last year. So I'd love Pep to play that Cruyff formation. Go back to the drawing boards of the Cruyffist philosophy that he adores. The Cruyff formation, the Bielsa formation from Newell's, that 3-3-1-3. Really unleash all those midfielders. Imagine that. You've got Rodri, Gundogan, De Bruyne and Grealish in the same midfield. You've got Bernardo Silva, Raheem Sterling and Phil Foden, let's say, as your front line. I mean, that's ridiculous. Imagine the control and manipulation of the ball and power you'd have there. Obviously, you'd have to work about how you deal with counterattacks. Maybe you have to put Walker in the back line or something. But, I mean, I hope Pep really experiments this year. This is like, what is it, his sixth year at City? This is uncharted territory for him. Like, he's, you know, normally done after three. So this is going to be really interesting to see develop.
And as Fergal was alluding to in terms of players that are missing out, we're obviously not addressing Kane just yet because that seems that it may not happen or might take a while to get through the door. So obviously if he comes in, then I think you play 4-3-3 and Kane's up front and you're fine. Yeah. But that means that even if the change of formation you've mentioned there, that means that Ferran Torres, who has had a really good end to the season and a really good summer, where's he going to play? I think he's the sort of false nine slash winger that can come on. Gabriel Jesus just falls down the pecking order again. As you said, I Bernardo Silva is amazing, so it's odd that they wouldn't keep him. But at the same point, Pep Guardiola was quite stern in the fact that he said we can only buy Grealish for 100 million because we're going to get 60 plus. From sales. So anyone that can get Bernardo Silva this season, as you said, it's a buyer's market. So yeah. I don't think City will be demanding a lot of money for him based on his quality. So I think that's a signing that if someone manages to snap up for between 40 and 60 million, considering that's what Man City paid for him when they signed him. If anyone can afford any of the Man City players, I think you could definitely ask about a few and probably get a solid inquiry, because even though they're fighting on four competitions, whichever formation they play, there's going to be one or two that are so far down the pecking order that they're probably going to want to just start playing some football.
Well, when you look at Bernardo as the one, right, that's the obvious. I mean, he's unhappy, but it's like, because you look at where he plays, it's like Bernardo and Sterling, I think, are the two that are really going to be rankling for minutes. Like Sterling was kind of at the end of last season, but then it almost worked for him because he had a great Euros because he hadn't been playing that much, so he was fitter. But this season, I think you're going to see Sterling and Bernardo going to two, because Mahrez, he's a special, he's a winger. He's an outright winger. So I think he'll get minutes regardless because he can play that wide role better than the others can because he's an actual winger. And the same will be said, I think, of Foden, because I think Foden plays that wide role. He plays like, remember Sane when he was at Man City? That's Foden on the left gives them what Sane used to give them. And as you
been
and
reading
I've,
my tweets,
no, well, that's what I was going to say. As you and I have often said, they really miss Leroy Sané. Don't tell them my secrets.
I was being polite.
No, but seriously though, that's exactly what it is. You look at Foden on the left, you're like, oh yeah, I remember they used to play like that, right? That was a while ago, and they really have missed Sané since they lost him. So those two, I think, are going to be all right because they play the role. What the problem with Sterling and with Bernardo is they're kind of tweeners. Which means they're gonna struggle to displace the specialist wingers, and they're not as good as De Bruyne and Grealish. Where they're okay right now is that Gabriel Jesus is no certainty to dominate and take that number nine spot. So they could make themselves into false nines. Where they're gonna really suffer is if Big HK comes in,
Looking at the other side of the city, Mo, your team, Manchester United. United fans would be almost forgiven for looking at the Grealish deal and kind of saying, yeah, what? We just brought in Jadon Sancho for 25-ish million less. And when you look at his stats, I know Jake touched on kind of the deeper down stats for Grealish, but the real in-your-face numbers for Sancho for Dortmund in the last two seasons are massively impressive. 25 goals, 37 assists. Yes, he was playing with Erling Haaland for the bulk of that, but these are really, really impressive numbers. United have been chasing him for 12 to 18 months. They've finally got the deal done. They managed to get it done for a little bit less money as well. And alongside that, at the other end of the pitch, they've brought in four times Champions League winner Rafa Varane. And when you're looking for an experienced centre-back to come in and partner Harry Maguire and propel a title bid in 2021, they don't come much better than Rafa Varane. Solskjaer and United have convinced him that, you know, the Real Madrid project is over. He's best served at finally going to United. These are two huge pieces of business. And whilst inevitably there's going to be so much attention on Grealish and City and what they're going to do, Ollie will be quite happy that despite the fact United have spent a big block of money, they're not front page news. They've just signed two quality players to propel them on another level.
For the first time, Virgil, for the first time since 2012, Man United have had a better transfer window than Man City. Man United, in 2012, they signed Van Persie ahead of Man City. That's the last time Man United have done better in the summer than Man City. Every other summer, since then, it's just been City and Chelsea and even Liverpool just being fantastically run. So well run. Leicester as well. My God, we'll get onto them in a minute. But oh my God, that club is amazing. Fantastically run. And United have just been an absolute embarrassment. Let's just call it what it is. Since summer 2013, United have been embarrassing since Alex Ferguson and David Gill left, right? And they've signed good players in that time, don't get me wrong, but it's always seemed to be either via agent connections or basically Mino Raiola or by almost accident. Like, but now they've signed them, they've gone out and signed themselves two unbelievable players. Like, I'm going to steal a stat before Jake can say it. I know he's been mad at me. Since 2018-19, only two players in Europe's top five leagues have registered 30-plus goals and 30-plus assists, right? One of them is the greatest player of all time. The other one is Jadon Sancho. When you're in the list of two and the other guy in that list is Messi, there's no words for how good you are. Jadon Sancho is so bizarre as well. And to bring you back to the England fans, the England pundits about, oh, going on about Grealish as the Messiah in the summer, it was so funny to watch that because I was sitting there thinking, Sancho's better than Grealish, like in terms of production and what they've done in the game. Sancho is demonstrably better than Grealish and more proven than Grealish. No one's clamoring for him to come on, and it's very strange. And it's because he plays in the Bundesliga, right? Obviously, they don't get BT Sport. You know, Gareth Southgate obviously doesn't get BT Sport because it was preposterous that England had this talent. And I mean, it was like funny. If you read anyone that follows German football, the German media were like, why is Sancho not on the pitch? They were baffled because if you've ever watched Dortmund since he's been there, you would understand that this guy is so ridiculously good. It's almost preposterous because it's gone under the radar, like you say, because it was such a long, drawn-out saga and they should have signed him last year, but for some reason they haggled. Like, who haggles with Dortmund? Who hasn't learned that lesson yet? Don't do it. Just pay what they want. But because United tried to haggle and whatever, they didn't get their man in. So it's sort of like, finally, they've got Sancho at last. It's like not even much fanfare about it. And Rafael Varane, I mean, I don't need to talk about Rafael. Everyone knows. Four-time Champions League winner, World Cup winner, Champions League Varane. The guy's nickname is Champions League Varane. Like, he's not going to partner Harry Maguire. Maguire's going to partner Rafael Varane. Let's get it straight, right? This is Rafael Varane's defence now. All those everyone's like, oh, Wan-Bissaka always comes in field. He's rubbish. Wan-Bissaka does that because Victor Lindelof does have no ownership of his space. Victor Lindelof has no presence. What says Wan-Bissaka's like, oh, I'm going to come in field because that's what you do when you're a defender. You gravitate in field unless your centre back says, no, stay out there. What are you doing? Stand there. I'm defending this area. Rafael Varane's going to be like, oi, no, Aaron, stand out there. You defend there. I'll defend this area, please. Because you look at all Real Madrid's defences, Danny Carvajal, whoever played it right back, Arbeloa, never came in field like that. They always defended wide properly. Because Varane and on the other side, Ramos, they had authority. And they were like, no, you stay out there. I'm defending this area. Varane, it's honestly perplexing. The Premier League has not signed a player this good, this accomplished, and this brilliant I don't think they ever have. Right, like players don't come into the Premier League like this. This is the kind of signing where the Premier League buys a player on the up, makes them into a global megastar, Henri, Van Nistelrooy, whoever, Fabregas. And then they go on to Barcelona, Real Madrid, PSG, Bayern Munich, whatever, what have you. This time, it's because obviously he's been at Real Madrid for 10 years. He's won everything there is to win at Real Madrid. He's won everything in the world of football except for the European Championships, right? So he feels like my journey is done. I've done 10 years at Madrid. That's impressive. Zidane has gone from Madrid. Madrid are in a period of change. They don't want to give me the new contract because of their financial rules. Let me move on. Let me find a new challenge. And United were like, hey, buddy, over here, you know? And so they've signed a bona fide world-class player in defence, a bona fide world-class talent, if not yet world-class player, in attack. It's honestly ridiculous. All they're lacking now is to sign it's a big bar, but sign a similar set of player in midfield. That's what they're lacking. That's the one thing that team still needs desperately. But I mean, wow. Like, they've done so well. And I'm perplexed because obviously, as you know, I'm hugely critical of the way that Man United do business in the market, but fair play. They've nailed it this time.
Jake, inevitably, there is going to be this comparison between Grealish and Sancho for so many reasons. It's an almost proxy battle between the two. It's City versus United. It's two England internationals. It's arguably two England internationals that are fighting for one place in that England team. We saw that during the Euros, that they were both bench options that Southgate would use one. He'd rarely use both together, etc. And the numbers, obviously, Grealish was 100 and Sancho was around 73 million. But inevitably, there is going to be a comparison between them. Sancho, we expect, he's going to play a similar role to what he did at Dortmund, which is either on the left or on the right-hand side of a front three. He's accomplished in both positions, but as Mo rightly said, a lot of that will depend on Rashford's return from injury, where Martial is deployed. We've talked about Grealish potentially kind of inverting his role. When you look at the numbers and when you look at the projected growth and the ceiling for these two players, who's got the better deal from United and City's perspective? Because both sets of fans are obviously delirious in terms of getting the players, but as the Squawker number cruncher, who do you think has got the better deal in terms of what their impact is going to be?
That's a good question.
That's an absolutely impossible question to ask. And we haven't done any podcast together yet, but I'm an absolute fence sitter. So I'll ramble for not as long as Mo usually does, but to ground a few stuff about Sancho and how good a signing that is. As Mo alluded to, his numbers are up there with everyone. And in terms of assists per 90 since that season that Mo mentioned, and when he really broke into the Dortmund team in 2018-19, he's second in Europe's top five leagues behind Thomas Müller, and he's averaging 0.54. Like, his creative output, regardless of who he had up front, even when Paco Alcacer was on a hot streak or supplying Marco Reus as a false nine, and even setting up Hakimi when he was playing as a pseudo right winger, Sancho's final ball in the final third is genuinely sensational. And yes, he might not get as many transition opportunities at Manchester United in the Premier League with teams sitting deeper, and yes, the overall sort of openness of the game will be more closed off, but he's excellent in tight spaces as well, and so is Grealish. They're both chance creating dribblers, ball carriers. I would say that Grealish is more sort of able to do everything by himself. As we mentioned at Aston Villa, he'd carry the ball 70 yards and set someone up. Sancho can do that, but Sancho's underrated strength, I think, is the ability he has to create partnerships on a pitch, and his interplay and his link play, and that sort of street 1-2 football that you need to dominate in small spaces. I mentioned Hakimi there. If you ever watched Sancho and Hakimi play together, it was amazing. When Hakimi left and they didn't have quite the presence on the right wing back, he moved further inside and started sliding reverse balls to Erling Haaland, which was rinse and repeat assists. And as you mentioned, can play all across the front line. And if we were going to put him in that same role as Grealish to try and get a direct comparison about their impact, one hyper-specific prediction I've got about Sancho. And when we were discussing agendas, we said there's so much that could still happen in the transfer window. Making a predictions podcast would probably be a bit sort of useless because it might change in a week. So I'm going to do something hyper-specific about Sancho. I think he will play on the left at the start because Rashford is injured, as we know. I think Greenwood's too good not to play, whether that is up front or on the right. But Sancho, during his time in the Bundesliga as well, not only did he rank first for chances created, take-ons completed, assists, he ranked highest for pre-assists, but there's a specific pass that Luke Shaw has already received from Jack Grealish multiple times. Marcus Rashford made it a trademark during his time when he was developing in that sort of more playmaker style role on the left. And Sancho playing on the left, I think what we'll see is rather than a really prolific assist to score or combo like Son and Kane last season, expect in the first half of the season for Sancho to play multiple through balls to Luke Shaw, who will be the highest player for Man United. And he'll be just cutting it back to Fernandez arriving late, who now doesn't have to do that through ball because Sancho is there to shoulder some of the creative responsibility. Mason Greenwood then can arrive from the right-hand side, which is going to be the less ball-dominant side if Sancho stays on the left. Or Martial or Cavani will be the penalty box poacher that converts it. So I've avoided the question of comparing Grealish and Sancho. I think Man United needed Sancho more than Man City needed Grealish. But as I said at the top, Grealish is world class. And if you can sign him, whether you need to sell a couple of players to do it, you do so.
Everyone's a winner. Everyone gets a trophy. But you know what? But you know what, though? That's actually true. They both signed the player they needed, right? That was it. City needed someone to become more unpredictable in the final third because they are a bit too unpredictable in the final third. They've got Grealish. United needed a world-class creative player in the final third. They got a world-class creative player in the final third. So it worked out for both teams.
Yeah, I agree. I think, as you put it, everyone's a winner except for the other 18 teams in the Premier League who are definitely not winners because they don't have Jadon Sancho or Jack Grealish. Right, we're going to take a quick break. Jake's going to tell me off for putting him on the spot, even though he was secretly delighted. After the break, we're going to be talking about Leicester. Some smart business from them. It's not just about City and United this summer. Brendan Rodgers has held on to his key men and has also strengthened exactly where he needs it. And we all know it's a big cliche, but Leicester are the dark horses. We'll catch you in a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker podcast. On today's show, it is all about the Premier League return. We are previewing the 2021-2022 campaign. Before the break, it was all about Manchester United and City, Sancho versus Grealish, who's done better, red versus blue. We're going to change tack for part two and we're looking at a bit of a dark horse candidate in Leicester. Now, anyone who watches the Premier League, and sorry Leicester fans, it's been heartbreak in the last two seasons, getting within a whisker of the top four and just missing out in back-to-back seasons. But this summer, Brendan Rodgers has done brilliantly. For me, he's done an absolutely fantastic job so far, and he's actually gone on another level. Jake, I'm going to go to you first on this. There's two pages to Brendan Rodgers' summer strategy. One of that has been retaining some of the fantastic players that are already within his ranks that won the FA Cup last season. And the other side is bringing in quality players to strengthen in areas that were needed. So looking at the players that have been retained, Wilfred Ndidi and Youri Tielemans are the main ones. A little bit of noise at the end of the season that United or Liverpool could potentially be interested. Rodgers has completely shut that down. There's absolutely no speculation over them leaving. And then on the other side, he's strengthened. Boubacari Samara's coming from Lille after winning the Ligue 1 title last season. 18 million and 27 million for the absolute goal machine that's Patson Daka. I've just had to double check his stats because I honestly thought I was seeing things. 51 goals in the last two seasons in the Austrian Bundesliga for Red Bull Salzburg. Based on those two variables, Rodgers has done an absolutely fantastic job this summer.
It just goes to show how good Leicester's transfer strategy always is. They're always a step ahead. They're always a step ahead of everyone and a step ahead of themselves. Going back to when Maguire was sold, they knew exactly what they were going to do to replace him and did it perfectly. And it's unfortunate that Fofana, who is another beacon of their incredible recruitment strategy, they seem to sign the right player from St. Etienne, unlike Arsenal, whose £30 million centre-back hasn't even played for them yet from that club. And unfortunately, his leg has been broken, I think was the verdict in the end, or there was a fracture. So
yep.
They're again dipping into the transfer market. Yannick Vestergaard is the player linked. And if they get him in, then it's just, oh, right, yeah, you know exactly what you're doing. It's almost like they have an emergency list on their wall. And they have, if this player goes, this is the player we sign. And it seems like that's set up 2 years in advance. What you said about Daka is, I think that's the most exciting signing. I think Samare will be someone that comes in to replace Ndidi if he needs to be replaced and plays in that double pivot to add a bit more solidity. But in the Community Shield, he showed glimpses of being able to carry the ball and break forward a bit more. So again, there's more to him than I know about personally, but I know that he is a name that's been mentioned with lots of clubs before Leicester signed him. And as you said, won the title in a really well-drilled Lille side who almost mirrored Leicester's ability to be really smart in the transfer window and make profit after profit and eventually win a trophy because of it. I think those two squads are quite comparable in what they achieved last season. But Patson Daka, as we know, as you mentioned, I think he scores a goal every 90 minutes on average in his career at Salzburg. That's incredible. His speed is something that, as Jamie Vardy does get older and can't smash as many Red Bulls before the game, he's going to slow down slightly more. But even last season, Jamie Vardy wasn't prolific in terms of actually breaking forward and scoring goals like we associate with him. A lot of his goals were penalties, and he actually recorded his best season for assists. So we could see Jamie Vardy retrain himself to be not the main man up front, but the supporting cast and using his incredible movement to create space for Iheanacho or Daka to play alongside him.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They're the best run club in England, I think, pound for pound especially. And you mentioned, Fergal, you mentioned the fact that they've fallen short 2 years in a row, and Jake touched on injuries. Injuries were a factor, but also the fact was that Vardy's goals dried up. If you look at the last two seasons, he's rushed to a really decent goal total, but by Christmas, after Christmas, he's fallen off. He scores like maybe 3-4 goals the entire rest of the season, if that. And that's because he's getting on now. He's in his mid-30s now. It's not sustainable, and he has to adjust.
He won the Golden Boot in 2019-20.
Yeah. But that was mostly from goals in the first half of the season. He's slowing down. Last season was incontrovertible. He was slowing down, and I think what I'm coming to the point was, I think before though they couldn't even afford to maybe take him out of the team, because you take him out of the team, it fundamentally alters everything. Whether he's playing as the running off the shoulder to be goal scorer, or as Jake said, like being more of a creative player, helping Iheanacho and Barnes and Maddison and that score goals. You need Vardy because he gives your team shape the way he plays. They had no one to replace him. Iheanacho is a completely different kind of forward. With Daka coming in, Daka now can replace Vardy. He can be the guy runs off the shoulder. And we saw in the Community Shield in his brief little cameo, runs off the shoulder, make runs in. Vardy can now maybe play 60 minutes, come off the bench, maybe Vardy starts on the bench, comes on for the last half an hour. You can manage Jamie Vardy now, which is kind of a terrifying prospect when you think about how good he's been up to now without really just playing 90 minutes constantly. Right now they can afford to manage Vardy and ration out his energy expenditure, his legs, his sprints, and that's going to help a lot in going and prolonging his career, but also helping Leicester be more dangerous. They've got a 1-2 punch now. Iheanacho, Maddison, and Barnes are sort of like the three players for two positions, right, in this 3-4-2-1 that they play. And then it's just Vardy or Daka, and you can start one, bench the other one, start the other one. And they've got such a great rotation now up front.
Given the way that they are going to set up and the players that have come in, Soumare, Daka, they're almost kind of putting it up to City and United and saying, we're not going to mirror you. We're not going to play Guardiola's 2-8s that like to, you know, get forward because they can rely on Fernandinho. As Mo said, there is so much flexibility. Soumare can play deep. They could play a flat three with Tielemans and Ndidi either side. They could play two deep, as they did last season with Tielemans and Ndidi, and then Maddison as a 10. They could maybe play Soumare further forward because we've seen how good he is at carrying the ball. They're probably one of the only teams in the top four or top six that have got two strikers in Daka and Vardy, or Iheanacho and Vardy, or Iheanacho and Daka. The names just keep flowing. If they want to get crosses into the box, they've got Barnes on one side. Mark Albrighton, we haven't even mentioned, who's probably one of the most underrated crossers in the Premier League. Ayoze Perez has shown little flashes. There's so much flexibility. But it's also refreshing to look at this and say, we're so used to teams that are maybe on the fringes of the top four trying to copy teams that are nailed on at being in the top four. By signing these players, Rodgers is essentially saying, I'll play my way, I'll structure the team how I want to do it, and we will put it up to you. We will be a challenge to you doing things the way that I want to do it.
Yeah, I just think it gives them the ability to play the underdog and play the favourite. The formations are usually built off your general style of play. And if you play three at the back, there's always a risk that you end up becoming five at the back and you play deep and hard to break down. But Leicester have wheeled that out against Man City and Chelsea in cup finals and won them both. So they can play against the big teams because they still have that incredible transition threat, which was born when Claudio Ranieri won the league with them. They won the league by playing 4-4-2, having Riyad Mahrez carry the ball, all Brighton as well, crossing it in often. But they were just an absolutely devastating counter-attack, and no one had worked out the sort of high lines that are now famous in the Premier League of Man City and Liverpool of being expertly well-drilled. They were still being created. So Leicester fell into the Premier League at the right time with one of the fastest, best counter-attacking strikers in his prime. But now, because they've developed and everyone appreciates them as a really good side, if they need to step on the gas and assert themselves, they can do that. As you said, they could play a 4-3-3 with Maddison as a number eight because he's good enough to do that, and they could reduce the amount of security they have in front of their defence. Or when they do play three at the back, they could play Barnes and someone else as one of the wing-backs to just absolutely wreak havoc. You've seen Callum Hudson-Odoi be used as a wing-back for Chelsea at the moment because when they are favourites, they play him as their widest player and the forwards are forwards. Leicester can repeat that with the players they've got. They are, again, I don't want to sort of steal your thunder in how you phrased it before, but they are incredibly tactically flexible and they have the ability to cater their team without deviating from a general style or cohesion. They have the ability to play to the opposition. And although that can be dangerous and lead to a lack of fluidity, and ideally you want to play the same way every week, I think for a team like Leicester, that's perfect. And that sets them up to win more points than most other teams in their perceived situation or general overall squad ability. Although I do believe they have one of the best squads in the league because it's well considered rather than just big names.
Yeah, I honestly think this season, I cannot wait to watch Leicester in full flight. The players that have come in, and I stand by what I said before. I do honestly think, even in comparison to Manchester City, I think they've got the most tactically flexible team in the league in terms of what they can do with their midfield unit, in terms of what they can do with their attacking unit. Manchester City might have bigger names and better individual players in certain positions, but the ability to play a two up front when Manchester City or Manchester United probably can't do that, the ability to have genuine crosses out wide to get the ball in, an absolute like-for-like replacement with Vardy in Patson Daka is such intelligent transfer business. And then retaining two of the best midfielders in the Premier League in Tielemans and in Didi is absolutely fantastic work. I cannot wait to watch Leicester City this season. Right, we're going to call it there for part two. Manchester United, Manchester City, and now Leicester City all in the bag. After the break, we're going to be looking at the promoted sides. The Premier League new boys, Norwich City and Watford, are back. And as for Brentford, after playoff heartbreak, the Bees are in the Premier League. We're going to be previewing the three new kids on the block in just a second. Hello and welcome back to the Squawker Talker Premier League Preview Podcast. We've talked about the big boys. Maybe not the small boys, but the new boys in the class this season are Norwich City, Watford and Brentford. First ever time in the Premier League for the Bees. Thomas Frank has finally, after so many missed opportunities, got them into the promised land of the Premier League. And before any Premier League campaign, there's always massive excitement about the teams that have come up. Will they be able to translate it? Players that were so central to a team's success across what's a marathon 46-game season. Can they do it in the Premier League? We're always excited to see. Everyone's got their take on it. So we're going to start with Norwich. Mo, championship champions last season. Daniel Farke, the club have been rewarded for sticking with him. He's got himself a new contract. When they were relegated last time round, they did lose a couple of players, Ben Godfrey, Jamal Lewis, who were really important to them, moved on. But they did keep the core. And we always talk about championship teams, that spine. That spine is what gets you promoted. And they've managed to do that. Grant Handley, Max Ahrens, Todd Cantwell, and of course Timo Pukki, who was sensational for them last time round, at least for half a season. And he was brilliant for them again last season in winning the championship and getting promoted. Daniel Farke was criticised last time round for essentially just backing the same players to do the same job that they did in the championship in the Premier League. And he's kind of gone for a mixed policy this time round. There are some new faces that have come in. Milot Rashica, who's coming from Werder Bremen for 10 million, is probably the jump out name. But when you look through the list of players that have come in, you do get the sense that Farke is still backing that same group of players. He's backing Pukki to score enough goals to keep them up, Cantwell to be creative, and Godfrey and Aarons to keep the door locked at the back. As a strategy, when you look at it on paper, is he right to have that confidence, or have you just got that slightly sinking feeling about Norwich once again?
You know, it's the same thing as it was last time when they came up. It's can Pukki score all season? Can he keep scoring all season? It's, you know, Norwich play really open, expansive, exciting kind of football. I think we all remember their first game of when they came up against Liverpool and they were brilliant. And you're like, oh my God, they're so good. And they technically were the more expansive and ambitious side. They lost the game 4-1, but they were the more ambitious side, right? And you're thinking, oh man, they're going to be great. And then they beat Man City. And you're like, these guys are going to be just fine because they're going to keep scoring goals and they're going to attack and they're going to, like Paco Gemes is Rayo Vallecano, if you can remember that far back in La Liga. They're just going to score more goals and they're going to win most of these games against these weaker teams. And they'll get hammered by a few of the big boys, sure. But they'll play their way and they'll start score enough goals. But what happened was they didn't play their way. They didn't keep imposing themselves on the teams around them. They just started losing and drawing those games because Pukki couldn't keep scoring goals. He scored scored 30 when they got promoted last time. He scored 26 they got promoted this time. He scored 11. In between those. Now, I know the Premier League is obviously a bigger jump up than the Championship, but the fact that your goal scorer was unable to score the goals and couldn't translate it, it meant that for all of Emi Buendia's excellence in the duels, and I'm just going to talk about him in a second, for all of Todd Cantwell's relentless industry, I mean, that man must have like six lungs, the amount he runs every game. You know, Max Aarons, Jamal Lewis were really good, you know, and it wasn't enough last time. Now, we've moved a year on. Max Aarons has been, he was going to go for Barcelona, then Dest went to Barcelona, now Max, he's still there. He was going to Bayern Munich, but he's still there at Norwich now. So he's been linked with two of the biggest clubs in the world, but it's somehow still at Norwich. I don't know if his agent is just very, very talented, or I don't know what's going on there. But, you know, they're a good team. They play really good football. They are definitely too good for the Championship. The problem is, are they good enough for the Premier League?
I think that's the main thing, really. I don't want to oversimplify Norwich's sort of success. But when you lose someone that is the most unique and in terms of output has just outrageous raw numbers, which I know, again, you can look too much into, but in the 2019-20 Premier League season when they were in the Premier League, he was the only player in the division that created 70 chances, completed 70 dribbles and made 70 tackles. Like, he did everything. I know he was criticised a lot for not scoring, and there was that weird moment where Daniel Farke said he's not in the side because our points per game is worse with him. And there was a bit of contention about, well, that's not really what you should be basing it off. But anyway, then in the Championship, he found the back of the net, did a double-double, and was the only player to do 70 in each of those metrics in that league as well. So you're losing a unique, complete all-rounder. Aston Villa have done sensationally. We were talking about losing Grealish earlier and talking about Leicester being a well-run club. Just a quick word on Aston Villa, clearly having an idea in place, and I thought that was brilliant, and they've had a brilliant summer. But Norwich, they haven't replaced that sort of style in the same way that Aston Villa have. As you said, they've bought in Rashica, who was relegated with Werder Bremen but has been talked about as an exciting prospect for quite a while now. He will be more of a winger than Buendia is, so they might change their style slightly. Billy Gilmore on loan is super exciting. We saw him, I don't want to say boss the England midfield in a 0-0, because he didn't necessarily do that, but more than held his own and was competitive. And I think he's got man of the match on every debut he's ever had. So expect him to get that in the first week against... Are they playing... They're playing they're playing Liverpool again, aren't they? It's the same opening fixture. Mm. So
yeah,
look out for Billy Gilmore there, who already has a man of the match award against Liverpool for Chelsea. But where you've said about Pukki scoring...
Just in case he's in the crowd.
Yeah,
he's always the threat. I just expect him to appear from somewhere and score. That would be just Norwich's luck. Suarez to be signed by Liverpool on next week.
Yeah, after La Liga has just plummeted into nothingness, Luis Suarez rejoins Liverpool and scores 8 against Norwich. But I think the Pukki situation in terms of goal scorers as well is I was quite excited about Adam Eder when he was breaking through. He scored a hat trick on his second start in senior football. So I was expecting him to break through, but after reading a bit around Norwich, he hasn't developed as they would like, purely because of, or not purely, but partly because of injuries and partly because of sort of inability to recreate that form. But if you look at him, you think that's a Premier League forward in terms of athleticism, movement, speed, and obviously has time to develop. And they've also brought in Josh Sargent, again from Werder Bremen, who were relegated. A US international, US soccer, as it were, has been quite good in the youth development process. Obviously, you saw Daryl Dike in the Championship last season do very well. Obviously, everyone knows about Pulisic and Weston McKennie, and stars like that are starting to develop all under the age of 25. So it's not as they've not been able to recreate Aston Villa's transfer strategy and saying, here's what Grealish is good at, let's replace all of that. They've tried to get in players that are relatively cheap. Obviously, they didn't get 100 million for Buendia. They got 30, which is still a lot, but you can't get much quality like he has for 10 million a pop if you split him into three players. So I just think he's such an amazing player and was so involved in everything they did. And I don't think they've replaced him well enough to be able to implement the same dominance that they did in the Championship last season.
Mo, before we look at Watford, I just want to ask you about Todd Cantwell. We talked about Buendia and the hole that he's going to leave in that team. And undoubtedly, Buendia has brought Todd Cantwell on a couple of levels. Having a partner like Buendia, who's so good, Jake called him an all-rounder before, and that's what he is. There's very little weakness in terms of his game as a midfielder, retention of possession, progressive with the ball, looking to break through the lines. But Cantwell probably kind of gets labelled as a bit of a runner, a set of lungs, a marathon man in midfield. 37 appearances last time round in the Premier League. He played 75% of their games in obviously what's a tough and demanding championship season last time out. But kind of a little bit with Grealish, maybe a little bit with James Maddison as well. How much about Todd Cantwell is the narrative and how much of it is demonstrated by his performances on the pitch? He is a good player, but for me, when I watch him play, I don't really see another gear necessarily to him. I think, as you touched on before, as Norwich as a team, I think he himself is the embodiment of that really good Championship player, but still big questions about him as a Premier League player. But because there's so much narrative around him, we tend to maybe overinflate him a bit.
Yeah, I see your point there. Because, I mean, I remember when they got relegated, the big thing everyone was saying was, right, someone's buying Buendia, someone's buying Campbell. And it turns out no one bought either of them, right? And that was partly because Norwich resisted the bids. But the fact that no one came in for Cantwell when he looked a perfect fit, Cantwell is not, he is a reactionary kind of player, which isn't to say he's a bad player, but what, like another kind of player like that is Pedro, I think is a great example of that kind of player, right? He plays off other people. He's not necessarily the playmaker. He's not necessarily the guy you want on the ball. He's like Müller. Thomas Müller is the archetype, I think, of this role, where he moves into space really well. He presses ferociously. He provides the kind of defensive cover and energy that you want, that you need, right? Especially when you've got like a ball-dominant creator like Buendia. He presses brilliantly. He engages defensively. He makes runs off the ball. And I think that's the key area. I do see a point that we overinflate, but at the same time, it's hard to properly gauge players like Cantwell because they really are only as good as the players that they're playing with because they play off the ball a lot and they're reactive a lot. And they rely on the ball players doing well. So if you have that kind of player, like Thomas Müller in a team that wasn't Bayern Munich would look incredibly ordinary, right? Because his primary attributes are associative. He links with teammates. He plays those beautiful wall passes to Lewandowski. If you're playing wall passes to average players, they're not going to look very good because he's flicking it back to Lewandowski, to Robin over the years. You know, it's suddenly you gain a better appreciation of them. When you're playing better players, there are more spaces for you to run into, to exploit. So Cantwell has that same thing where in the Championship, Pukki is lights up. Buendia is lights up. So he has a lot of space to move into. He can find areas to do damage and pop up with goals and assists and just general effective play. In the Premier League, where Pukki struggled, I mean, Pukki went the last 13 games of the Premier League season without scoring a goal in 1920. So, like, that's, you know, when he struggles like that, it's just Buendia. It, again, and even Buendia, like Jake says, has his problems. It's like, it's harder for Cantwell to sort of make an impression. Like, Cantwell to me is one of those big underrated guys where some, I think part of the reason why he hasn't moved is probably because Norwich value him very highly and don't want to sell him for anything less than a lot of money. And teams don't want to spend a lot of money on him. But I think if someone could get him, a better club could get him, like a Liverpool, say, that has a lot of really good on-the-ball players, and he could just press and work off the ball and make runs into space, I think he could just take off. But he needs to play in that sort of very specific kind of situation to really excel, which obviously it's hard to come by outside of the club you're already at, which is Norwich.
Just quickly on Cantwell, though, he was their second top scorer in the Premier League and got 6 goals when they went up, and no one else scored more than 2, obviously, other than Pukki. So, yeah, I know no one was saying that he was a bad player or anything, but I think he is a really strong player. And I was saying that they can't replace Buendia or they've lost a star player, but I think a lot of Norwich fans would argue that the Dirham Deco, as he's sort of affectionately known, is more than capable of stepping up if he's given the opportunity. So I just wanted to make sure we weren't coming across as saying that that Todd Cantwell is a load of rubbish. And I know you weren't saying that.
I love Todd.
Norwich are intriguing because they've lost Buendia and because of their style of play. And Cantwell will certainly be the player that I'll be looking at to see how well he does again in his second pop at the Premier League.
Oh, yeah. My son loves Cantwell. So if I badmouth him, he's gonna come at me and like just start hitting me with stuff if I start badmouthing Cantwell. So
I feel like a terrible person now. I feel like I've slurred the name of Todd Cantwell. Right, let's
You're
move
bullying
on
Todd
before
Cantwell,
I put my foot in it with it. Before I put my foot in it with Todd Cantwell any further, Watford, Jake, came up second in behind Norwich, 7 points behind them in the final table shake-up. Sisco, the brilliantly named Sisco, came in December, part of this constant managerial merry-go-round that goes on at Vicarage Road. He stabilised things, he managed to get a good strong run together in 2021 and get them back into the Premier League. We talked about this idea of a spine and experience. Watford followed a similar path. Ben Foster, Tom Cleverley, Troy Deeney. Deeney didn't play a massive amount of football, but he got some really, really important goals, particularly at the crunch end of the campaign. Again, looking at some of the arrivals that have come in, arguably maybe a little bit more exciting than Norwich. Emmanuel Dennis, his goal return is not excellent, but when we look at his performances for Club Bruges in the Champions League, he was quite eye-catching. But for me, it's Imran Lauzer, who comes in from Nantes, 7 goals from 33 games in Ligue 1 last season. Given the fact that Watford's brief is stay up, keep it solid, keep it nice and tight, we can kind of garnish the team with one or two impressive players. Are they maybe in a stronger position than Norwich, or do you just think it's, again, a little bit of a sinking feeling, they haven't reacted enough, and ultimately they're probably going to sack at least 5 managers before the end of the season?
Yeah, I think Watford set the record for most managers used / sacked in a single Premier League season the last time they were up, and it didn't work in the end. So we can probably expect the same thing if it starts off slowly. In terms of their transfer business, I know we keep sort of whipping out the striker cliche, and Josh King on a free, he's got Premier League experience, was always strong at Bournemouth, didn't do anything after joining Everton for 6 months. So I think he's might be lacking a bit of match fitness there in terms of getting up to speed. I've spoken to a lot of Watford fans. They're really concerned about the fact that I think their centre-back partnership has been the same set of 4 players rotated for what seems like 10 years. But they had the best defence in the Championship last season. And I always think it's easier to transfer a style of play which relies on not conceding than scoring. Norwich, as we've spoken about, were by far the best team, but they got absolutely pummeled and conceded shed loads of goals because the step up in quality was different. Whereas we've seen that if you just put 10 men behind the ball, that's really difficult to score against. And you're more likely to get a point playing that way if you have a much lower quality of squad than you have trying to match people like Man City. There are obviously exceptions to the rule, and it's not something that's a broad brush and a strategy that can always guarantee success. But we saw last season that teams that play on transition and play deep and try to counterattack won more games against bigger teams than usual. And I think we saw that trend in the European Championships as well. teams like France, even they preferred playing without the ball because you have more space when you win the ball back from an interception or a tackle. It's just the way that teams set up. So although I don't think Watford will have a season to remember, and again, that's me being sort of quite dismissive of the work that has been done to create a solid defence, and they obviously have Ismail Assar still in the squad who has the potential to really shine again, especially if they rely on him in transition. I just don't think their squad is good enough to score enough goals, even if they aren't conceding many. And yeah, as I said, players like Troy Deeney and Craig Cathcart, who have been admirable servants in the Championship and to the club in general, I don't want to sort of besmirch their legacy in any way, but I think it's got to the point, it's another year in their career. And I think Watford fans, from the perspective that I've got, is that they're really nervous about the fact there hasn't been a bit of a refresh. And in a different way to Norwich, I just think they're going to struggle again this season.
We've got a bit of a base to build on with Norwich and Watford based on previous Premier League seasons. But Mo, Brentford, we've got nothing to work on in terms of them as a Premier League club. Thomas Frank has been really, really impressive as a Championship manager. He's obviously had frustration trying to get them up in previous years. But 2021 is the year of the bees. They're here. They're into the Premier League. We get to see Frank in the Premier League. And arguably, most importantly, we get to see Ivan Toney. Now, looking at the numbers based on the Championship, Ivan Toney has absolutely torn the goal record to bits in the last 12 months. 31 Championship goals in 2020-21. No one else has done that since 1992. Guy Whittingham, who did it all them years back. And we kind of look at the Championship every season. There's always someone that gets around 20, 25 goals. And, you know, a la Pukki, a la Deeney, they're mooted as, can they make the step up? You know, they've been impressive. Ivan Toney is another level on top of that. He's a very confident player. He's super quick. He scores all different types of goals. And whilst you look through the rest of the Brentford team, they might not be that inspiring, 1-10, but 11, Toney looks absolutely excellent.
Yeah, he does. And it's, I mean, we've been hammering it all with all these promoted sides. You need to score goals to stay in the Premier League. That's the most important thing you can do. Keeping goals out is important, yeah, but unless you're scoring goals, your overall lack of quality, even if you're playing for 0-0s, like Jake said, you can get away with that for a while. But eventually, if you're not scoring goals, it's 0-0, 0-0, 0-0. Eventually, teams will just start scoring on you because they realise you have no goal threat, which is what happened to West Brom last year. And what I think will happen to Watford this year. Ivan Toney scores goals, man. Ivan Toney just scores goals. Like, you look at it, like...
And lots of them.
3 seasons ago, 23 goals in the Champions in League One. 2 seasons ago, 26 goals in League One. Last season, 33 goals overall, all competitions, not just in the league. In the league, it's 16 2 years ago, 24 2 years ago, 30. He's going up the leagues and he's getting better. 31 in the Championship. He's ridiculous. He's an actual goal scorer. So everything now that Brentford do, and they play open football, they play expansive football, they're great to watch. All that stuff is always sort of like, he's always saying, well, it's nice to do that, but you have to score goals. Roy Keane, I think he said it like 100 times over the course of the years, the hardest thing to do in football is scoring goals. It's like, I think he said it every single game he punted. The hardest thing to do in football is scoring. Yes, he's right. It is the hardest thing to do. And Brentford have themselves a goal scorer who seems to get better the higher the level he plays at, who seems to thrive on pressure and expectation and adversity and people saying you're not good enough. And they've got a great team besides that. Christopher Asia coming into defence, he's a great defender. He's won titles with Celtic. Now, okay, fine, with Celtic, but we've seen with Van Dijk, when you win titles, you win titles. Having that experience is valuable, even if it is in a lower league, quality league, in bracket marks, like Scotland, right? Henrik Larsson, everyone used to laugh at him winning titles in Scotland, then he went to Barcelona and did it there as well. So when you win titles, right? And then Frank Onyeka, I think, is the one for me I like. Obviously, Brentford have a weird relationship with Midtjylland, but he's really good. He can carry the ball. If you look at him, you watch him play, he seems tailor-made for the Premier League. He can tackle, get involved, get stuck in, as it were, but then he can carry the ball forward in really adventurous ways. And I really like that. And I think that's really, that's going to make their midfield really exciting. And that's going to sort of supplement even Ivan Toney as well. And just, again, I just can't get over Ivan Toney though. The goals, the sheer goal, the goal numbers, 31, 16, 24, 31. And he's 25 as well. This is the other number about Toney worth thinking. This is not some young kid who's just come on out of nowhere and might be a bit overawed. He's been like Harry Kane was. I'm not saying he's Harry Kane. Don't get on my back. But like Harry Kane, he was loaned around by Barnsley, Shrewsbury, Scunthorpe, Wigan, Scunthorpe again. Like he was sent out. He was not regarded. He spent the early part of his youth like being loaned out to various clubs and never really fitting in. So he's worked his way up. He's suffered. He's seen the setbacks. Right, he's not like some fresh-eyed kid who's like, I can take the world on, and he's going to get called us a reality. He's had reality hit him in the face multiple times. He was at Newcastle in 2015-16, played twice in the Premier League, and then that's it. And then, when they got relegated. And so he's tasted defeat. I know what it's like to lose, right? What does Thanos say? I know what it's like to lose. Like, it's lightning. It turns the legs to jelly. He's had his legs turned to jelly, and now he's back with the Infinity Gauntlet. I mean, probably not. But, still, this guy is now back. He's failed before. He knows what it's like to lose. He's tasted defeat. He's not going to be shocked if Brentford lose the first three games of the season. It's not going to throw him out of stride. It's not going to put him off. Not going to dampen his morale. His determination. He will keep scoring goals. So as long as Brentford can keep the rest of the team playing at the same sort of level, same sort of expansive, brave kind of football they've been playing, I think they're going to be just fine. Honestly, I think Tony's goals are going to keep them up.
Before we wrap up, I just want to ask you both dead quick. We've been maybe a little bit unfair looking at Norwich and Watford and Brentford and the possibility of it being three up and three down. So just quickly, Jake, go to you first on this. Looking at some of the other Premier League teams that could be in the conversation for relegation, who do you think is, from the already established pack in the Premier League, the most at risk of dropping into to the bottom three this season?
It's really tough because Crystal Palace are usually my go-to for this because they've got an ageing squad and they always, again, like we've said, they rely on not conceding, and sometimes that isn't quite enough. But they've come in and signed some really exciting players. Jury's out on Patrick Vieira. So they maybe will be in contention. Brighton obviously were down there last season, but I really like Brighton. And if they, again, had a great striker, they probably would have been in the top six last season based on sort of underlying metrics and the way they played. So it's really difficult. And I almost can't remember exactly who is in the league that could be going down. As soon as you think of someone like Burnley, or you say, well, they've got an extremely defined style of play and that's really repeatable and it served them well. Chris Wood gets you 10 goals a season. There's all of those cliches that we've whipped around. And if Brentford can employ a similar strategy like that, it's weird saying that they're the most likely to stay up because, as you said, Fergal, we haven't seen them. But again, underlying metrics, although Norwich won the league by a margin, Brentford conceded the fewest shots inside the box and had the highest expected goals and have a striker that broke the championship goal scoring record. So on paper, I'd say they're my favourite. And I probably just will default to Crystal Palace because I just don't know how all of their players are going to gel together. Although I do think they've had an interesting, if not sort of the jury's out on it being a successful transfer window.
Newcastle United. That's your answer.
In a word, or two words.
Yeah, look, I don't want them to go down. I think the Premier League is infinitely more interesting with Newcastle in it. They are a really, really unique club. And they represent a part of the country which otherwise, Sunderland aren't coming back anytime soon. So, the North East needs representation. I don't want them to go down. I like Newcastle. I think they're going to go down. I think there's big problems at the club. Fans aren't happy. They've got some good players. I mean, Saint-Maximin's one of those watchable guys in the Premier League. Let's get it straight. He's fantastic. I love watching him. Miguel Amaron's a bundle of fun to watch, right? And they've given Callum Wilson the number 9 shirt. I mean, that's a big shirt to wear in Newcastle, right? So, they keep those guys fit. They've got a chance. But, you just worry about the mood around the camp as much as anything else. The mood around that place. Palace also, how are they going to cope without Roy Hodgson? So long they've been defined by the way he approaches things. I mean, without him, I don't know. Burnley at some point is going to catch up with Sean Dyche, right? He can't keep getting away with it at some point. By the way, if you're Brighton, please, if you're Brighton, go and tell Chelsea, loan Tammy Abraham from Chelsea for a season with a buy option. I swear to God, you'll finish top six. Like Jake says, you'll finish top six, top seven with Tammy Abraham in your team. Please do it, Brighton. Please. You are so good. You just need a goal scorer. Get him. They're going to want to sell him after they get rid of Lukaku. Just go in and say, look, we'll buy him from you. Give us Tammy Abraham and he'll be amazing. He'll score 20 plus Premier League goals if Brighton sign him.
Yeah, that could be an interesting shout. Relegation predictions, transfer predictions, we've covered it all. Manchester United, Manchester City, Leicester, the relegation picture, who's staying up, who's going down, and who is potentially being catapulted into oblivion. I think we're going to call it a day for the Squawker Talker Premier League preview show. Jake, Mo, thanks so much for joining me.
Hey, my pleasure. And shout out Liverpool. Keep an eye on them. They've got four good centre-backs now, suddenly. Didn't have any last season. Now they've got four.
Yeah, as Mo keeps doing by extending his answers, we couldn't cover everything, but we will be covering more of it as we go through and get more of those transfers through the door to make bolder predictions. So, yeah, exciting stuff. And it was good to be back on.
Great stuff. Yeah, Mo, shout out to Liverpool. No one's ever heard of them before. Little club coming up on the rails, Liverpool. I think they're going to make a big splash. If you like Mo's hot takes, particularly when they're a bit more mainstream like that, then don't forget to check out the podcast right the way through the season. If you click subscribe on this episode, you can get a brand new one as soon as it is ready. Don't forget to give us a follow on social media as well. We're going to be clipping all these up so you can get the real hot takes, the red hot takes, as soon as you want them at Squawker. Follow, share, like, and everything in between. And we'll catch you again very, very soon.